Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Senate Finance today. 3 minutes after 9 a.m. Tuesday, February 10th, 2009. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, the other two senators. One of them streaming in the room right now, Senator Elton. And Senator Huggins is in the building. He's detained at another committee for the next few minutes, and he'll be joining us here shortly. Over the next couple of days, we're going to begin a review of the state's primary investment asset accounts. Today we're going to talk about the permanent fund, and we're going to do the public retirement trust funds tomorrow, and then the Constitution of Budget Reserve also tomorrow, and try to put these together. And these meetings are for information of the committee and the public, and will not be taking public testimony. Principal objectives of having these back-to-back accounts is to get a better understanding of their interrelationships and their different management time horizons, the size and scope of what they're dealing with, how they interact. We'll be touching most likely a little bit on their investment policy. Clearly, we'll be looking at their asset allocation. Some of the concerns that we have is the similarities within the allocations. We're kind of curious on that. And then, of course, the investment performance, which is a worldwide issue, so we'll deal with that as time goes on. I'm going to set the stage for our discussion this morning with a market and economic overview and capital market forecast from Mr. Michael O'Leary of Callan Associates, who's been here numerous times in the past. The second part of the meeting, we want to look at the performance of the permanent fund, and we'll continue that discussion tomorrow if necessary. So there's been a little bit of a communication gap between the Finance Committee and the permanent fund, so the presentations aren't quite laid out as we anticipated, so we're going to be nimble and just adapt. We're going to have Mr. Callan go ahead and present, and then it'll give us time to formulate questions overnight, and then he'll be back tomorrow and we can further our discussion. But again, tomorrow's meeting is going to concentrate on the retirement trust and the constitutional budget reserve, even though we may back up for a little bit of close up on today's meeting. Mr. O'Leary and his firm, Callan Associates, are the state's principal investment advisors. For those at home that are watching and aren't as familiar with him as the members at the table and in the audience here, Mr. O'Leary, they advise the Permanent Fund, the Alaska Retirement Fund, and the state's Treasury Division of the Department of Revenue. Since Callan advises the state on all these accounts, we asked O'Leary to be available over the next couple of days to participate in the discussion and help us understand what we're have just been through, what we're facing, and the interrelationship of our major savings accounts, and then to offer his expert advice and ability for questions. The first discussion again is going to be on market and economic overview and the 09 capital market projections. And with us today, already sitting at the end of the table, excited and ready to present to Senate Finance, Mr. O'Leary, and if you could introduce yourself and who you represent, along with Mr. Burns next to you, maybe he can identify himself and who he represents. I'm sure the people of the state of Alaska that don't know you would be very interested in what you do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Michael Burns, Executive Director of the Permanent Fund Corporation. It's my pleasure to have with me today Mr. O'Leary, who identified as our principal consultant to the board. Before I turn it over to him, just one thing I think it's interesting to put in people's minds, because this gets very complicated. But I think there's a couple of simple numbers, and it's not much more than checkbook accounting, but I think it is a good view of our history. If you think over the life of the fund, from mineral royalties, from general fund appropriations, and from legal settlements, we have deposited about $13.4 billion into the permanent fund. Over the life of the fund, we have paid out $16.7 billion in dividends. And we have today between $28 and $29 billion, depending on where the markets, which are not very attractive this morning, is. And I think it's just to keep in perspective what an incredibly successful socioeconomic experiment this has been over the life of the fund. It's not as successful as it was a year ago, but I just think those are very interesting numbers. But I would like to turn this over to Mr. O'Leary. As I said, Callan provides the board with asset allocation advice and performance measurement, manager searches, and other duties as assigned, and has for at least 20 years?
1990.
Yeah. So without any further, Michael?
For the record, my name is Michael O'Leary. I'm an executive vice president with Callan Associates, a national investment consulting firm with headquarters in San Francisco. I thought we would begin this morning by reviewing the painful history of 2008. Discussing very briefly some of the causes, which are undoubtedly well known to everybody at this table, and then shift into our projections for the next 5 to 10 years. Along the way, I'll give you a snapshot of how the fund, the permanent fund, did during 2008, and of course, I'll try to limit this to no more than 30 minutes so that there's ample time to follow up with detailed Q&A. On page number one of your handout, and you can see it on the screen, we just highlighted the obvious that it was a terrible market environment for all asset classes. Credit markets around the world froze. When we look back on 2008, we'll see that there were extraordinary government policy actions initiated not only in the United States, but in major developed markets and indeed in emerging economies. There was an unprecedented, in modern history, post-World War II history, flight to quality. And as seen best in the return differences between Treasury securities and every other type of fixed income security. It's hard to remember that in July there was talk of $200 a barrel oil, and the actual price was in the $140 a barrel range, and we've seen that correct to sub $40. So remarkable changes. The US dollar, which had been weak for a protracted period, strengthened during 2008, and this is reflective of the flight to quality. On page number two, I won't go through all these, but it's a laundry list of the major financial news items that impacted the market, starting with the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac being placed into conservatorship, the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, which happened in mid-September, which was the proximate cause of the horrendous equity declines during the fourth quarter. The forced sale, if you would, of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs converting to bank holding companies so that they'd be eligible for financial assistance, Washington Mutual being seized by regulators and its assets sold to J.P. Morgan. There's a timeline on the right of this page that I won't dwell on, but I do want to call your attention to the December 16th number, where the Federal Reserve target interest rate, now on Fed funds, was reduced to 0 to 25 basis points. On page 3, in the upper left graph, there's a depiction of the Treasury yield curve. And the blue line represents the Treasury yield curve as of the end of calendar 08. September 30 is the green line, and a year prior, December 07, is the yellow-orange line. And you can see the remarkable change in Treasury rates during the year. By the end of the year, the 30-year bond was yielding less than 3%. An absolutely remarkable yield decline. Over on the right, it's a very busy graph, and what it depicts is the spread, the yield differential for various sectors of the bond market over treasuries. And if you look down at the bottom of the page, you can see the absolute returns for various sections of the bond market relative to treasuries. For example, corporate high yield investments, and this is just in the quarter, down 17.9% in absolute return, down 24.9% relative to like duration treasuries. Go on to page 4, we show the calendar year performance for the last several years for the U.S. stock market and various components of it, international stocks, and for the fixed income markets. We also show inflation. I call your attention to the 2008 inflation number, 0.09. What's remarkable is that during the year, on a year-over-year basis, it seemed as though inflation were going to be up about 5%. So all that decline in the CPI occurred in the latter half of the year. You'll also see in the shaded areas the 5-year compounded returns for each of these market indices for the 5 years that ended at the end of 07 and the 5 years that ended at the end of 08. And the same is repeated for the 10 years and the 15 years. And clearly, what it demonstrates as you scan through those numbers is the incredible change in the long-term return for various asset categories because of 1 year. For example, if you look at the Russell 3000, so a very broad measure of the stock market, look at the column, the 15-year column, 93 to 07, you'll see that index had a return of about 10.5%. Move forward 1 year, so now we're looking at the 15 years ended at the end of 08, and that return is only 6.36%. You go to the 5-year number, it's actually a negative number. I'm sorry, the 10-year number, it's actually a negative number, because that 10-year span includes basically two bear markets, the bear market following dot-com and then last year. And I do this not to state the obvious, but to give you, to help you understand how one significant year can have a huge impact on longer-term results. And that doesn't mean it should be dismissed. It just is a fact. To give you some sense of the magnitude of that. There was no place to hide. On page 5, we show real estate returns. These graphs are complex. But if you look down at the bottom of the page, NCREIF is the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries. It is the...
Mr. Callen, can we back up to slide four, please?
Yes.
Can you hit on the asset class of fixed income and cash?
Yes. The Lehman Aggregate Bond Index is the, now it's been relabeled the Barclays Capital Bond Aggregate. It is a measure of investment grade bonds. And you can see over over the 15-year period, including 08, its return is almost as great as the return for the Russell 3000. And over all shorter periods, it is far superior. So with the clearly, and that was really driven largely by Treasury returns, long-term Treasury returns. The index below it is the Citi Non-U.S. Bond Index. That's a government bond index denominated. This is denominated in U.S. dollars, but of course the bonds are issued in foreign currency terms. So that return reflects both the return in local currency terms plus the changes in the value of the dollar. And cash is the 90-day T-bill.
Thank you.
So on page five, it just was explaining down at the bottom of the page, many institutional funds invest in direct real estate. It's an important part of their asset allocation. And so this is to provide a sense of real estate returns. The blue line represents the total return of the index, and the red line reflects the income component of the index. And you can see there's a sharp decline in the fourth quarter of 08 for the values assigned to real estate investments, direct real estate investments.
Mr. Callen, could you stop there and just briefly remind us how real estate is priced in this tracking model? Page five.
Yeah. Real estate in these in this index is based on appraisals. It is a this is unlevered real estate. They take the leverage effective leverage out of the index when they're creating it. It is comprised of hundreds of properties held by institutional investors throughout the United States. And there is detailed information available on the income that's generated, the proportion of the properties that are leased, et cetera. And what typically happens is the properties in the index are appraised at least annually. But if there's a transaction, the transaction is captured, the actual value of it. During those periods when the asset isn't appraised, the appraisal methodology is applied to the financials for the property during that period, the period under consideration. So what's happened recently, of course, is that vacancies did increase a little bit, but not a heck of a lot. But the required yield increased more because risk interest rates are higher than the spread difference is wider than it had been. And I can unearth a graph that shows that in gory detail subsequently. Okay. Page 7 was repeated. Page 8, just to give you a perspective, shows the calendar year performance for the Callen's public fund database. And the red dot reflects the preliminary numbers, return numbers for the Alaska Permanent Fund. So negative 25.7% during 2008, which was essentially at median. One of the reasons for showing you that NCREIF chart on real estate was to try to give you some sense for how comparisons can be muddied. Many public funds report their real estate returns with a quarter lag. So as of the end of December, they're in effect reporting the 12 months ended September. The permanent fund values its real estate on a current quarter basis with one investment as an exception. So it is more, it has already incorporated the significant decline in the valuation of real estate, whereas others in the distribution here may or may not have. Our sense is that the normal is to lag it. What I call your attention to on this graph is back in 01 and 02, the permanent fund did much better than the median public fund during those declining market environments. Lagged a little bit in the recovery of 03, was very competitive in 04, 05. 06, the return was very attractive, but not, but essentially median. 07, the return was very attractive. And 08, the return was essentially at median. Moving on to page 9, we're all being bombarded with statements that this is an unprecedented stock market environment, financial market environment, and it is. Every market environment is unique. This gives you this graph, which is a histogram of the S&P, of for most of the period, the S&P index 500 composite index. For the first 100 years or so, it's some other index or compilation of stocks. But what it shows is for each calendar year, the return for this measure, for a broad measure of stocks. And you can see 2008 is highlighted. For the stock market as measured by the S&P 500, stocks were down 37%. In 2008. Most of the time, more times than not, the stock market has produced a positive return. And if you look at those bars from 0 to 10%, from 10 to 20%, and from 20 to 30%, you can see that's where the majority of the years have fallen. But there have been outliers in both directions, and we do have to go back to the 30s to find years as bad as 2008 was. The significance of this is whenever anybody does modeling or talks about stock market returns, they'll point out things like 1 in 4 years the stock market is down, or maybe even a little bit more than that. And they'll talk about the typical decline. And this decline, while atypical, is consistent with other bear markets. What is very unusual is that much of it was concentrated in so short a period. Much of the decline occurred in the six-month period, in the second half of the year.
So is the bear market over?
I didn't make that statement.
So this, the measurement then,
yeah, well,
is not complete.
Potentially not complete. Certainly not complete through January of 09, which was also a negative month. Here's another way of looking at it. On page 10, the average five-year return, the actual five-year return for periods ending December of 1930 through December 31st of 2008 is depicted here with the blue line. So you can see for the most recent 5 years, the S&P 500 had an annualized return over 5 years of negative 2.19%. The average of all the averages, 5 year periods, was 10.35%. If you look on the left side of the graph, you can see how bad the 5 year returns were during the 1930s. With declines of, I'd say, between negative 10 and negative 16 or 17. Page 11 shows investment grade credit spreads from 79 through 2000. Credit spread is, of course, the difference in returns and yields between debt instruments that are highly rated over comparable maturity treasury securities. And you can see by the end of 2000, we were at unprecedented levels for that period, for the 1979 through 2008 period. Now, subsequent to year end, credit spreads have narrowed a little bit. Okay, what do we think of are the implications of the financial crisis? Nothing earth-shattering, but very significant nonetheless. The structure of the U.S. financial system is changed permanently. There's no question about that. Traditional investment banks and their influence on the economy has been altered, and we think that that is a permanent alteration. There is absolutely no question in our minds that the degree of oversight and regulation and the degree of permitted leverage in the banking system will be reduced, has been and will be reduced. There's also no question that the massive stimulative efforts undertaken thus far, plus those that are on the table, will result in a huge expansion in federal debt. There's no question but that the U.S. consumer has been forced to delever. There's been a sharp decline in consumer wealth because of the decline in the value of houses. And certainly there's been a huge decline in their holding, in the value of their financial assets. That would seem to have to translate into lower spending and consumption. Other consequences will include deferred retirements, second jobs, et cetera. Page 13 shows the section from Global Insights, the composition of real GDP, how much is from consumption, how much is from residential investment, and so on. And you can see the importance of the consumer. Page 14 shows real GDP annual growth change. These numbers, there have been subsequent modifications of the reported numbers for 2008, but basically what we had was the decline in the second half of the year, principally in the fourth quarter in real GDP. And the last bar there is the Global Insights projection for real GDP growth, negative growth, in 2009. I'm just going to pass over, rather than read to you, all the bullet points is on page 15. and 16. Although on 16, I do want to highlight a couple of points. The optimists in the financial community look at the government intervention and say, an awful lot has already been done. An awful lot has been done since the beginning, since the middle of last year, actually since the beginning of last year, but massively since the middle of last year. And the impact of that arrives with a lag. We have seen the situation deteriorate during the fourth quarter, but also by the end of December, there were some signs, not of improvement, but of stabilization. There have been subsequently minor signs of improvement in financial conditions. And here I'm referring primarily to credit risk spreads. New bonds have actually been issued over the last several weeks by investment grade issuers and received well by the market at high prices, at big spreads. But during the fourth quarter, that didn't happen. There's absolutely no question, though, that the economy right now in Q1 is continuing to decline in real terms. Spending is down. We haven't seen any cessation in the housing slowdown, although there are some indications of, in some areas, emerging stability. The bulls would say markets begin to recover before the economy actually recovers. The average recession has been 10 months in duration. This one technically began at the beginning of 08, although I think for many people they would say it really began in middle of 08. And more times than not, the markets have begun to anticipate the recovery. Today, if you survey 10 or 15 major economists, they'll probably say no sooner than July, and at the other end of the spectrum, maybe Q1 of 2010, as being the place where things begin to improve. The pessimistic view is that the damage to the financial system is just so extreme that we're not going to be able to repair it in such a way as to get real growth going again. And concern with the possibility of deflation as opposed to inflation. And on page 17, every year we go through a long-term planning exercise for expected returns. And as I've said to this committee before, we're always going to project the central estimate of stock returns to be above bond returns and bond returns to be above cash, because that's rational. Doesn't mean that it's going to happen. And we try to capture that variability by the range of expected returns as measured statistically. We do think inflation will be a non-issue in 2009 and not a significant issue in 2010, but that during the forecast period, inflation will become more of an issue. We think that stocks will anticipate the recovery. They'll lead it, not cause it, but anticipate it. And we've studied literally every stock market recovery subsequent to a major bear market, and clearly early on the returns are very attractive. The key issue is figuring out when is too early, and when does it begin?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
On that point, does that statement depend upon what happens with the stimulus package and how that is implemented, or when you make that statement, what credence do you give to the president's stimulus package?
I know that we don't know it in detail because it really isn't out there in detail, and I think one of the biggest impacts is on confidence, and I think the composition of the final package will importantly affect confidence. There are many, and so I'm not hedging. I'm going to give you a flat out opinion, but I want to be sure you have the context for the opinion. My understanding is that the bill that is likely to be enacted is primarily spending, and the criticism of the bill, that is majority spending as opposed to tax cuts, and the composition of the spending is less stimulative than the critics would have liked to have seen. That is, that it, the impact of the spending components of the bill are later in the horizon in the spending program than those that wanted a jump start to spending. So that's what we're operating with. Part of that assessment reflects our view toward longer term inflation. Will spending help the economy? Will tax cuts, further tax cuts, help the economy shorter term? Yes. We put a little bit greater weight on our concern with respect to the financial system. And personally, I listened to the Treasury Secretary this morning, and I was expecting and hoping for more details than were given. So that, to me, is still a big but very important question mark. So I wish I could be more definitive, but that's where we are. So our expectation is that there will be meaningful stimulus. We don't think that there's any question about that, but we also believe that really affecting consumer attitudes is critically important.
Just a second, Senator.
Just, and Mr. O'Leary, you can maybe clarify, I mean, your last statement. I mean, if a federal stimulus package does that affect consumer attitudes? I mean, how do you get to that issue if it is a big concern? I mean, changing the attitude of the consumer. If you don't do it through a stimulus package, is there? I just don't see a way to do that.
Yeah, I think for many, the housing market is particularly important to them. And if they see a package that holds some promise of helping to stabilize housing or reduce the risk of foreclosure, that could have a very positive effect on attitude. If there were an immediate increase in their own financial position through payroll tax holidays or reductions, they immediately feel better because they are, in the short term at least, better off. So the more of that type of action directly affecting individual consumers, I think the more beneficial it will be for their confidence.
Can I just a short follow-up? I mean, can you do that through the remainder of the TARP funds then? I mean, is that where you would see that occurring?
No, I think this is the package that is being debated or has been voted upon, right, scheduled to have been voted upon at noon today by the Senate. And then, of course, it's got to go to conference and, you know, who knows what the final product will look like.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay. So we're going to shift into some of the numbers very quickly, and then I'll wrap it up. But I look forward to the subsequent discussion and dialogue. If you presume that the world is an ending, and some don't make that presumption. I mean, some say we're in a very significant spiral and it's going to persist. We're not in that camp. So if you believe that in the foreseeable future, the next 2 years, there will be the beginning of a recovery, you can get to a position where you say financial assets look very attractively valued. It's easy to make that case for investment grade bonds. It's harder to make the case, but I think the case is just as strong, for equities. It's harder to make the case because we know that in the short term, earnings are going to be dismal. But if you can make the case that there will be an economic recovery, the leveraged operating flexibility of major corporations is tremendous. And so when people look at valuation levels for equities, they think in terms of normal earnings power, not 2008 expected earnings or 2009 expected earnings. They're thinking about 5 years from now, where will corporate earnings be? And when you take that kind of look at the equity markets in light of this 37%+ decline last year, stocks appear to be very attractively valued. Of course there's risk, and of course there will be individual blow-ups, and that's why broad diversification is essential. But that's our view. Okay, page 19, this is from J.P. Morgan. This is just sort of a proof statement for, I want to run through these very quickly. The average economic expansion since 1900, so this includes, obviously, the decade of the 30s. The average expansion has lasted 45 months, the average recession 14 months. Over in the table on the right, you'll see the post-World War II recessions, where the average has been 10 months in length. During the recession, in the post-World War II era, stocks went up 1.4% on average. All that says is that they began to recover before the recession ended. And you can look down the individual ones and you see it didn't hold true all the time. You look at 1973, which was actually a multiple year bear market, 73 and 74, and it was in total about 49% from top to bottom. So it was a very severe market decline. It still ended up in negative ground after emerging from recession, so it didn't make it all back. And the same in the 01 recession, which of course coincided with the dot-com bust. Talked a lot about interest rates. This is a graph of the yield to worst. on the Lehman Aggregate Bond Index from 2001 through January 16th of 2009 of this year. And you can see, and what that yield to worst means, it presumes that if somebody, if it's advantageous for the issuer of the bond to call the bond, then it gets called, that type of thing. At the end of 08, the yield to worst on the Lehman Ag was just under 4%, 3.99, and subsequently yields declined even further. So interest rates are low. You can use that, this index, that yield to worst, as sort of a blind, naive proxy for future bond returns, five-year bond returns. So you could say over the next 5 years, you'd expect bonds to return near 4%. Now, we think actually they'll do a little bit better than that, but I'll save that for a second. Page 21.
Stop there on that chart on 20. Yeah. If we just back up to 10/31, then under that scenario, we'd be like 5.7% or so.
Yep.
So that's
over the 5 years from that point forward. Yeah.
And then.
And you would have gotten a big portion of that between 10/31 and now, because interest rates have declined.
And maybe for those watching at home, maybe you can briefly explain what you're talking about. The inverse relationship with value versus yield.
Yeah, if a simple example, there's a concept called duration. So interest rate sensitivity. Are you shaking your head? That maybe I'm getting too complex. Basically, if interest rates go up, the value of existing bonds declines, because the rational investor will say, "Well, why should I buy that 4% yield coupon bond when a new one's coming out that I can buy that's yielding 5%.
So when we're looking at yields down at 3.75 in that range, when yields pop back up to 5.5, for example,
the value of those bonds will decline.
We should put downward pressure on the bond portfolio.
Yes. Okay. And we treasuries, which were great last year, have been terrible so far in calendar 09, because long-term treasury rates have gone up as some of the panic in the financial markets dissipated. This graph on page 21 gives you some sense of the composition of bond market total return. The graph in the upper left shows the total return, so the sum of the market value change plus income. The graph in the upper right just shows the income return, coupon return. And then the graph in the lower left shows the price change. So the income return component tends to be pretty stable, but the price change can be pretty volatile, and that reflects the changes in the general level of interest rates. I've moved ahead to page 23. These are the conclusions. One of the things that got us into this mess was clearly too much liquidity, and people didn't require, investors didn't require enough of a premium for the risk that they were taking. One manifestation of that was obviously the subprime mess, where people were being given loans and the risk wasn't reflected in the price that they were paying for the loans. But it wasn't limited to subprime. That occurred across the financial spectrum. Okay. If you move ahead to page 25, rather, this just in narrative tells you what our expectations are for the major asset categories. And so for bonds, we expect long-term return of about 5.25%. And that's really sort of a schizophrenic forecast in that we expect investment-grade bonds to do well and treasuries not to do so well because treasuries have already done so extraordinarily well. So if
can you shorten that into maybe a 3-year and a 5-year and a 10-year kind of a rollout? Let's comment into a more of a time frame.
Yeah, in the shorter term, treasuries. So over the next year or two, treasuries are likely to not produce a very attractive return because their starting interest rate levels are so low and the issuance needs for the Treasury so great. And so if you had to pick between a bond that had a high-quality bond, but a bond that had some credit risk and a Treasury obligation, and you wanted to make money, the bond with a high-quality credit bond would return more, in our view. Now, if we're wrong about the eventual recovery, that isn't a great place to be, but that you're being paid a significant premium over treasuries today for that. Let me put the numbers in a different way. If I had to guess at a 5 or 6 year return for investment credit bonds, highly rated bonds, not junk bonds, I could easily be in the 6%+ range. If I had to make the same guess for treasuries, I'd be near 3. And another way to think about that is our expectation, our longer-term expectation for total returns from TIPS, Treasury inflation-protected securities, is about 4.9%. So much higher than for treasuries because we don't think that the market is pricing in future inflation. And the TIPS would produce only about a 2% return today because inflation is so low, but if inflation turns out to be 2.9%, that you can easily get up to the 4.9% return from TIPS. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead to page 26. The permanent fund, and this, Mr. Chairman, gets to one of the other issues that we're going to be discussing. The permanent fund is that. It is a permanent fund. So it has an advantage that almost very few other pools of capital have. It has a long-term investment horizon. Its objectives are, of course, to preserve the purchasing power over the long term of the pool of assets and to make distributions that are consistent with that. And of course, the legislature has determined the pace of distributions through the history of the fund. Major university endowments have a similar mission. The distribution policies may be slightly different or expressed differently, but basically their objective is to preserve and enhance the purchasing powers of the corpus and to make distributions per that institution's support of its objectives. NACUMBO, the National Association of College and University Business Officers, annually commissions a very comprehensive survey of college and university endowments. This is the most recent data. They do it on a June fiscal year basis. 774 institutions participated. And what I like about this graph is it shows, a table, it shows how these institutions invest their money, have invested their money. And I encourage you to focus on the greater than $1 billion entity line. So that includes the Harvards, the Yales, the Stanfords, the major endowments. And in many ways, they're sort of a great peer group for the permanent fund. 40% of the assets of that subset, on average, invested in equities of all kind. Only less than 11% invested in fixed income. 6% in real estate. More than 22% in hedge funds. 10% in private equity, 3.6% in venture capital, and 5.3% in natural resources.
So, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that there's a big spread here between the $25 million and $1 billion, and for us, we're substantially higher than that. So of these 774 institutions, how many were greater than $1 billion?
I'll get that number for you. It was a very small number. It is, I would say, in the 20-ish range, very small.
And of those, is there a big spread in their allocation of their investments?
I can get you the full report and see. This reflects the dollars equal weighted, unless noted otherwise, and you can see down at the bottom, you can see the difference between the dollar weighted average and the equal weighted average, and the dollar weighted average is dominated by those 20 big guys. So even within, and yes, within the 20, there is a wide spread, but not as wide as the spread that you see when you look at the averages of the over billion to the next group down, the 500 to a billion. But we can get you the more detailed information.
And then if we can take just a brief explanation on hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, and natural resources. Are those all forms of equity ownership versus debt ownership?
Well, the private equity, venture capital, and venture capital certainly are. They are predominantly illiquid equity investment. As you know, both the permanent fund and the state pension pools invest in private equity. Their order of, and they don't have this line distinction between private equity and venture capital. It's all in one bucket, so if you sum these two, as opposed to the almost 14% here, the targets are about 7% for both entities.
And then maybe you can give us a 30-second blast on hedge funds and what's going on in that industry.
Hedge funds are really not an asset class. It's an approach of an amalgamation of investment strategies and characteristics. So they're private partnerships that typically invest predominantly in public securities using a variety of strategies. There are thousands, 8,000 plus hedge funds, and so it's very difficult to generalize. They oftentimes have specific little niches by types. We can provide you background information on them, but what they try to do is to achieve a return that is like an equity return, publicly traded equity return, without the volatility. Within this big universe of funds, though, there are some that have a more conservative tilt, where on average they're looking to achieve a return that is greater than that that's available from the bond market and exhibits similar volatility, and others that are more like equity, but just try to have less shorter-term volatility than an equity-only, a traditional equity-only portfolio. Hedge funds are very expensive. The general partner in the limited partnership is paid a fee, but also a percent of profits above a high watermark. And as you could expect, when hedge funds can, in some cases, pursue very aggressive investment strategies, and when they do and they're not working, there can be a run for the from the underlying investors to cash out, and that may take some time for them to do.
Senator Elton.
Thank you. And Mr. O'Leary, as you look at the larger funds, the 500 million plus, and this is 2008, I mean, how do these numbers compare to 2007 for the higher funds? I mean, for example, did in 2007 was their percentage in equities, was it higher, and did they start moving to hedge funds, private equity, and some of the other
I think if we go back 5+ years, you would find the equity allocation higher, the hedge fund and private equity allocations lower, and the bond allocation higher. So reduction in the bond allocation has been the primary source of funding, but in some cases they've also reduced their equity to get a different form of equity management from a segment of the hedge fund world.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the, you said there were approximately 20 or so that were above the $1 billion?
Yeah, I used 20 to reflect the small number.
Okay. Do you know how many there are? What is the range then? How high do we go? How many are 5 billion or just roughly, or what is the highest?
I would think Harvard. They're now just about our size.
Okay.
They've come down substantially.
Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and those were, I think, the big three.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay, so very, as I understand your objectives, a very important objective of these discussions as it pertains to the permanent fund is to say, well, what, you know, what are others confronted with a similar mission doing? And this is our thinking of what would be the closest. Private foundations have similar investment policies. I work with a major private foundation, and half of their assets are illiquid, invested in real estate, absolute return, at slight hedge funds, and private equity.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. And to that point, it's interesting looking at maybe, you know, how the money has flowed, you know, out of equities and into some of the others. I mean, are managers' options for the permanent fund somewhat constrained negatively because of the asset allocation that's prescribed, the recipe? And, I mean, do we have the flexibility that the other large funds have in
You, the law was changed. We're in the third year now that allows us to invest this as a prudent investor. So the statutory list is gone. What we don't have the probably the ability, I mean, when you talk about these private endowments, whether it be Harvard or Yale, I think they have a risk tolerance that a public fund probably doesn't have, so they'll be more aggressive. But we're not constrained other than just the fact we're a public fund. I think someone said one of the differences is that a university foundation, you know, graduates a new group of donors every May, so they have this continuous thing. I think I heard someone say once, our donors died about 10 million years ago, and we're not making any more dinosaurs, so oil revenue is a finite resource.
If we go back, if I might, Mr. Chair, just to further expand on that response, if we go back to the days when there was the list, the permanent fund was at a significant disadvantage. The legislature has been very responsive to requests for liberalization for a long time and granted it in terms of the credit quality and indeed providing the basket clause the ability to do things that weren't otherwise specifically approved. And then ultimately in changing the authority or giving the permanent fund board the authority to modify things. The pension system has had greater flexibility. So as an illustration of the difference, the RMB has actually more money invested in private equity today than the permanent fund because it was able to start earlier. But their longer term targets are still the same. So I hope that's responsive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and continue.
Yes, sir. Here are the numbers, and this on page 27 of our projections, and we are trying to be a little bit more transparent in our expectations, and in the process we run the risk of confusing people. So let me try to provide some clarity. We have always focused on 5-year return estimates, but financial markets are very volatile, and we all recognize if you have a dollar invested and it goes down 50%, you need to go up 100% to break even. So we're showing you an arithmetic mean return. So that's what could happen in a single year. What's the average of the expectations? And then we're looking at geometric mean returns for 5 and 10 years. And you see the 5-year number is lower than the arithmetic mean number, but we're using the arithmetic mean to calculate the 5-year number. So it reflects the effect of volatility. And the further you extend the time horizon, the less meaningful the volatility is. So all these numbers, with the exception of the notable exception of fixed income, reflect an increase in 5-year return from the numbers that we have had previously. And the reason for that is, of course, the significant decline that's occurred. None of these numbers get that back in the short run. But if we had a 9% broad domestic equity return number last year as a 5-year projection, now that same number would be, in our view, 9.63.
So then at the end of the 5-year cycle, or a 6-year cycle, depending on how you're going to measure it, are you saying that we won't get back to where the expectations were a year ago? Odds are.
Yeah, let me go back. All the way to where the heck is that? here, I'm sorry, to page 10. Okay, our projections now are consistent, just as they were a year ago, are consistent with the type of volatility and range of five-year returns that you see depicted in this graph. And so over the last 5 years, the return was negative 2.19%. We could have a five-year period where it's over 20%. And that would be consistent with the projections that we're building into our modeling. Because remember, the five-year number here is the midpoint or the average of the of thousands of simulations of returns calculated using the arithmetic mean return assumption and the annual standard deviation and looking at history. And two standard deviations captures 95% of the range of expectations. So if you have a standard deviation of 16%, two standard deviations is 32%. So you could have, if our estimate is 963 for 5 years, you can have a pretty wide range of returns. What do we really think? We think that the odds, given the magnitude of this decline, given our presumption that the economy is going to eventually recover, we think that we will enjoy a period of above-average returns over the next 5 years.
When did you recognize or get concerned that the previous returns weren't going to materialize, that we were heading into a area of several months or a year or longer where the returns may be substantially disfavorable than the projections?
I'm not sure I follow the question, Senator. We don't wake up and change. We have this disciplined process of constantly reviewing the expectations, and the change that occurred is the assumption of the underlying assumptions about the economy. If we go back a year ago, the expectation was that we wouldn't have a deep recession. So what happened subsequent to July really had to affect our thinking about what was a reasonable rate of return and what was.
If I could parse your words a little bit, you mentioned a steep recession. When did you start to get concerned that we may be heading into a recession, a normal recession?
Some time ago, yeah, 07.
Okay, so 07, you were concerned that your firm was starting to be concerned that the business cycle might come to its natural conclusion. And then, naturally, as time goes on, things got worse in 08. And when did you? Well, I'll just wait there for. I got some other questions coming, but go ahead, continue.
Okay, page 28. I won't bore you with this. Just shows our estimates of correlation.
I have one question on a time frame in September of 08. What were your projections at that point?
We had modified our projections from what we had had a year ago. We had extensive conversations with clients expressing great concern about the situation in the market, in the credit markets. Remember, Lehman went bankrupt in September 15th. And the markets literally weren't functioning. So you couldn't get many normal transactions done. I mean, there were stories of wanting of investors wanting to sell a short-term piece of paper, 90-day instrument, and having a high-quality name and having to accept give the buyer of that an annualized return of almost 24% in order to
So if you had $1 billion, would you invest that in high risk or low risk?
If I had it today?
No, in September of 2008.
Let me rephrase the question. If we handed you $1 billion in September, told you we wanted it back the following September, or 5 Septembers from then, or 20 years from then, how would you handle that question?
Give you the easy answer. If it were 1 year from then, you'd say, well, it has to be in something safe. So a bond portfolio. If you said 20 years from then and a minimal possibility of significant cash outflow, the answer would be that's a pretty long investment horizon and there'd be a very heavy equity commitment. The shorter you get, the lower the equity type of commitment. With a norm being these days a balanced portfolio in the 60-70% range is a pretty normal allocation across the industry for longer term money, and 5 years at the short end and out longer. The key variable is what's the probability of that money going away. The more certain you are that the money isn't going to go away, the more aggressive it is easy to become. So, and I'll translate it into if you're doing retirement planning, individual retirement planning, and you have only 5 years to retirement, but then you're in retirement, it is very common for you to be advised to have meaningful equity participation. If, however, it's a kid's college savings fund and you know that in 5 years a big portion of it is going to go to pay tuition, then it should be a little bit more conservative. It should be more conservative, still balanced, but more conservative. So does that respond to your question or just muddy the water?
Well, I think my question, I guess, is we have the permanent fund and we have aggressive investments and non-aggressive investments. And at that point in time, knowing that we have the permanent fund, and unlike other funds, we know that it's permanent. Would you recommend in September of 2008 that $1 billion be invested in more aggressive or less aggressive funds, knowing what we know now about the market and what you knew then?
Yeah. If I knew that the market was going to decline 20% after I invested, I certainly wouldn't have invested. I would have been very willing to begin to invest any reserves in more aggressive investments as that market environment was unfolding. We don't attempt to time markets. We don't advise clients to time markets. We advise clients to have a long-range policy and to try to maintain it through good times and bad. And so if the markets are going against you, that means you have to be thinking about how are you going to get back to your policy target. So, for example, almost every institutional fund in the country had less equity than their target equity by the end of calendar 08, because equities went down more than bonds went down. Right? So every institutional investor had to scratch their head and say, what are we going to do about that? Are we going to change our target, make our target more conservative, or are we going to move money or allocate contributions to move us back toward our target?
And what would your recommendation have been to an investor in September of 2008?
They weren't really out of balance in September. So in September, the recommendation would have been to maintain their policy, their long-run policy. In December, the recommendation would have been to begin the rebalancing to their target.
I think we can. We'll get back to that tomorrow.
And perhaps we'll want to get back to that this tomorrow too. But I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting to talk about September. But I mean, if you were given $1 billion now, would you be more heavily? Would you be shifting back toward equities?
If I were under my target, my long-term target, in light of the new projections, absolutely. And other risk assets. It's not just equities. It could be high yield bonds. It could be even real estate. I mean, I'm working with a major corporation in doing an asset allocation, asset liability analysis right now, and that corporation has never owned direct real estate in its portfolio. And it certainly doesn't want to run out and buy direct real estate in the middle of a real estate recession. But that they are very seriously considering establishing it as a category for investment in their pension plan and implementing that over the next 12 months. Because maybe the best opportunities will be right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have about a half hour left, Mr. Callens. So you could kind of gauge your presentation.
If you go to page 29, this table takes the permanent funds policy, existing asset allocation policy, and uses our capital market, our long-term capital market projections. It's just an update. And you can see the five-year simulated return, given the new inputs, is 9%. That's opposed to something on the order of 8% last year, looking forward. And that reflects the change in our expectations, because there is no change in the policy here. The board hasn't been presented with this. They'll be seeing that at their meeting next week.
Could you maybe tomorrow, if last year was 8%, could you take last year's market point and project that forward 8%? You know, your linear line, and then take this new resetted market point at 9.35 and project it out so we can visually see.
Yeah, the 9.35 is that one-year arithmetic return. I'd encourage you to look at the 9% line, which is the five-year number. So that's the apples to apples.
Or you can do even the 10-year, give it a longer time horizon, just so we could kind of see this. There's a discussion on a market reset.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
See if they ever cross.
Looked at graphically, this is page 30, all those mixes from the preceding page and the permanent funds target mix. And so what this says to us is that the policy, the target policy, is essentially on the efficient frontier. Our consulting advice is always to people that not to pick a particular point on the efficient frontier, but to pick an area of the efficient frontier that makes sense to them, that is consistent with their risk and return expectations. And so here's another way to think about it. If you go back and look at that 9% line, if you think inflation is going to be 275, which is what we think, the 9% provides positive real return above inflation. And the volatility for the total portfolio is estimated at 12.82%. Remember, two standard deviations, 95% of the time, and the other 5% is even more of an outlier. There's a bunch of supplemental material that I would be happy to use to address questions, but I just want to call your attention to something on page 42 in the supplemental material, and that's that yield spread. This is a ratio of municipal bond index yield to the 10-year treasury. And this is something that people, you know, we all know that there are credit issues in among municipalities. And so some of the increase in the ratio of tax-exempt yield to taxable yield in the form of a treasury. But, I mean, this is absolutely extraordinary. And this is something that helps demonstrate how significant the disruptions in the credit markets have been. And then just explanation, GMO, Grantham Mayo and Van Otterloo is a major investment management firm. They do a great job of monthly publishing a 7-year projected real returns. They have had a history of being very conservative. Late in 08 is the first time that I recall where they had more expected returns above that dotted red line than below it. J.P. Morgan similarly does a very comprehensive projection process, and their the most recent projections that I have from them is as of the end of November. And you'll see there's an expected return number and a longer-term compound return number and volatility. And I offer those just to provide assurance to you all that the types of numbers that we're using are numbers that are consistent with what many in the financial industry are using as long-term projections. And page 46, this is these folks. There is annually, right at the end of the calendar year, a service asks many noted authorities in the financial industry to make their single price target projection for the equity market. And of course, I should note that so far this year we're down, depending on the day, 7, 8, 9%. So some of these projections, this is from the year-end level higher, and this, in my way of thinking, helps illustrate the folly in trying to market time when some of the best in the business are making short-run projections. You wouldn't, it's meant to be just a reminder that market timing is something that people have not been able to master.
to help us with tomorrow's discussion and tying in today's, could you, or maybe the administration could bring back in a table format, use December 31st, 08 and December 31st, 07 allocations for the permanent fund, the retirement portfolio. You can do the PERS and TERS in aggregate. There's not much difference between them. And then the CBR.
I don't have any information on the CBR.
All right, well, we could.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's available.
Yeah.
But it'd be nice if they're in table format, and if there is, you know, if you want to add on back in 07 some of the projections or the standard deviation numbers or what have you, but other related information you may think is pertinent, but I'd like you to have for the committee the allocation in dollars and percentages. We have more questions. Senator Olson.
Actually, I do, Mr. Chairman. Mr. O'Leary, you made a comment a while ago that the your consulting group does not play the market by anticipating the markets. But I thought that was the art of investment, that you went ahead and anticipated the market so that you could, the better artist gets the better return. And I don't want to get off on that, but my real question has to do with the recommendation that you have. And many of us remember the double-digit inflation that happened back in the late 70s, where our purchasing power was certainly held in question. What are your recommendations now, especially to the permanent fund related to that? So as we see this stimulus package, we had the bailout of the that was put forth by the previous federal administration. We've got the stimulus package that may go and indeed cause inflation, although I do notice you talk about deflation within your presentation. What recommendations do you have for those of us that are looking at the program?
For very long-term investors, we think that it is very prudent to have a significant exposure, a hedge, if you would, to inflation in the form of real assets. And they can take a lot of different forms. Real estate is that, infrastructure investment, timber, farmland, art, and TIPS, an allocation to treasury inflation protected securities. Indeed, equities over the long run do a better job of preserving purchasing power than fixed. So the more one is concerned with future inflation, the greater the emphasis should be on those types of asset categories. And that is particularly true with an entity like the permanent fund that doesn't have, that has much greater flexibility because of its limited liquidity needs. I mean, a pension system at some point, when the last beneficiary turns out the lights, ideally there's nothing left in the fund. I mean, the system is designed to meet the requirements of the participants, given the best thinking with regard to that future liability.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Barr?
Senator, through the chair, if I just might add, one of the things we work with, and you talk about inflation, and you know, one of the asset classes would be commodities, which we're not in at this time. But we have tried to, and we haven't come to a conclusion, but I think it's interesting to think about, is that we try to come up with the present value of future cash flows from oil revenues. You know, and you can't put that on your balance sheet, but it is a protection. Now, even if the price of oil goes up, it's a diminishing protection because, you know, the volumes are going down, but there is that exposure to commodities, and if you come back with a present value of it, it does enter into your thought process.
Mr. Burns, could you kind of walk us through what you're currently doing with the permanent fund on your rebalancing. The subject came up earlier today, and particularly how you deal with the less liquid in investments if you're forced into a position to rebalance when it's...
Mr. Chair, made a presentation to the Anchorage Chamber just Friday, and this came up or was part of it. Let me walk you through where we are, you know, where our targets and the bands around the targets are, and where we actually are. And I start with domestic fixed income, and our target is 19% plus or minus 6%, which would be 25, and we're at 26.67, so we're slightly over in domestic fixed income. Some of that is a holding pattern or a holding place for some underfunded asset classes that we get capital calls for, specifically infrastructure. So, but we're still a little bit high in domestic fixed income. Domestic equities, our target is 26% plus or minus 5. We're at 23.11, so within the bands. International equity, our target is 13% plus or minus 3. We're at 10.53. Global equities, we're at 14. Our target is 14 plus or minus 4. And we're at 11.57. International fixed income, our target is 3, and again, that is a plus or minus 3%, and we're at 3.99% there. Now, those are the liquid assets. On the illiquid side, in real estate, our target is 10%, plus or minus 3, and we're at 13.09, so we're on the outside of that. I think we'll have some valuations that will bring that down. I think, as Mr. O'Leary mentioned earlier, we're about a quarter ahead of most funds, but there's probably still some changes in values that will adjust that. Private equity, we're at 6% plus or minus 5, and we're only at 2.13 there. And we really don't control the outflow there. We've committed funds to partnerships. It's how fast they can find targets to invest in. We don't want to push that or try to accelerate that. We'd like to get that invested over time. In the private equity world, they call it vintage years. Absolute return, our target is right now 6 plus or minus 3, and we're at 7.58. And then infrastructure, which is the newest asset class, our target is 3 plus or minus 3. We're only at 1.33, and that's the extra cash that's in domestic fixed income. So, you know, across the board, we're still a little bit heavy in fixed income, a little light in equities, but we are within our bands, with the exception of the real estate, which I think we like to refer to it as more optical than actually mathematic. And
Mr. Burns, could you maybe put that in a
yes.
data table for us tomorrow?
I'd be glad to.
But yeah, it's good information. Then, so there's no concern or issues being backed into the real estate portfolio and forced to rebalance in a weak marketplace to put in the permanent fund in a position to have to sell out their premium real estate? We're not dealing with that issue.
Mr. Chair, no, there's no pressure to try to sell real estate at this point. We have sold down substantially some of our real estate investment trusts. Public real estate trust. But our privately owned real estate, we look at the market all the time. We look at what we own, and if we can find the right buyer or the right situation. But the market's pretty slow right now.
Okay. We have other questions? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. O'Leary, one of our constituents in Mat-Su, I'll just call him Bob, is over the last couple years plus, let's call it three, has fired up lots of amber-colored flares and red flares talking about deflation. Unfortunately, he was right. And I know some people around the table maybe have gotten some of his letters. I know he sent them to the permanent fund over time. It was pretty persistent. When did you see the deflationary cycle kicking in?
I think that was a consequence of the credit markets locking up. So that would have occurred in the second half of 08.
Yeah.
And until that time, the inflation running well above expectations was the bigger problem. You go back for the 18 months, 3 years, ended June of 08, inflation ramping up was much more of a concern. I mean, that's, I pointed to the price of oil in as illustrative of that, but it was across all those areas. So the decline in prices, I don't think that we're in a deflationary period now. I think that at all. But I grant that there is clearly the risk of that.
Well,
go ahead and follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look at your slide number 17 under your first bullet. Slow going until 2010. Deflation is a real problem once again. That's your words. So I don't want to quibble over that. I would, though, like to go to your next bullet where you say, outlook, inflation will be contained and low interest rates will persist. Now, I don't know, when I listen to the different news networks and the economists, as they are speculating about what's going to happen with our large spending appetite, that inflation is inevitable. But it doesn't appear to be borne out by your analysis, at least through 2010. Could you help us out with that?
Yeah, and the context for this comment about the Fed is focused on stabilizing the financial system and kickstarting the economy. Their mindset, and I personally believe that it's a correct mindset, is that if they don't get credit moving, then deflation is a real concern.
Okay. Yeah, fair
but
enough.
The expectation is that they will. Our expectation is that they will. And there is so much slack in the economy now. Capacity utilization is so low. Inventories are high in a lot of areas that we don't see demand pull inflation, if you would, being an issue in certainly in 09 and through most of 2010.
Right. So, but do you anticipate that inflation going forward at some point in time is a force to be reckoned with?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any other questions for Mr. Burns or Mr. Larry? Maybe Mr. Burns, you can give us a 1 minute blast on the realized and unrealized losses the permanent facing and the difference on the statutory net income and the gap accounting for net income and how you perceive any impacts, if any, on the ability to pay a dividend and or manage the permanent fund.
Mr. Chair, if you go back to 2002, the fund was in a similar situation, not as dramatic, but the math was the same challenge. The markets righted themselves, and dividend was paid as agreed, although it was, at the timing was very tight. Subsequent to that, the board asked the Department of Law, the Attorney General, to come up with an opinion as to what was the correct accounting if the notional value of principal was actually less than the market value of the fund. The opinion they came up with at that point in time in 2003 was that unrealized gains and losses should be allocated to principal. The earnings reserve stood by itself. That is still the operative opinion. We have had four or five audits with KPMG utilizing that methodology. They seem to have no quarrel with it. So we have the accounting professionals, the legal professionals stating that. We have asked, the board asked for the current administration's Department of Law to refresh that opinion or see if they had any differences with it. They are in the process of that. They have not issued an opinion at this point, but we had a hearing with House Finance maybe 10 days ago, and they were very strong that they see no difference. They have no differences with that opinion. How soon they can get to actually publishing that is another question, but they are in agreement with that position. As of 12/31, we don't have the January 31st financials finished yet, but as of 12/31, we have about $3.9 billion in the earnings reserve. Yeah, it's hard to estimate what a dividend might be. We would draw on that. The number we're working with right now, and it's a very rough number, as volatile as these markets are, we think the dividend probably will be somewhere around $1 billion this year. That's down from about $1.3 billion last year. That's exclusive of the energy rebate. That's just the permanent part. So at this point in time, there's plenty of money in the earnings reserve to pay a dividend of that magnitude.
They will probably revisit that later on in the session as we find out. It is a concern that a lot of the citizens in the state have, probably ranking fairly high in what kind of work we do here in the legislature is their dividend. Senator Olson.
Mr. Byrne, just so I'm clear, that when somebody calls my office from out in Bush, Alaska, and says, are we going to get a dividend this year, I can assure them that, yes, indeed, they will, in spite of the rumors that the corpus and the deposits are not coinciding with what's in statute?
Senator, through the chair, I don't know if in today's markets if we can assure people of anything. You know, if someone, you know, this is, like I said, this is an opinion of the Department of Law. It is being refreshed by a different Department of Law. They're in agreement with it. It is an opinion. You know, anybody can challenge that in court.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's.
We're gonna. Do we have any other questions before we adjourn the meeting? Okay. Well, thank everybody for coming, and I'd like the two of you to hang around for a minute. I'd like to talk to you for a minute. Tomorrow we're going to continue the conversation with Mr. O'Leary. We'll pick up any questions that we have remaining on the permanent fund. If the members have any of that, let me know. We'll be looking at the public retirement trust funds tomorrow, along with the constitutional budget reserve, starting 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Meeting adjourned.